who seems to have deflated. So flat is he, lying on the ground. I wonder suddenly if it's my fault he got out. Perhaps I didn't shut Joanna's door properly last night, and poor Max has been loping around the grounds in the dark. I let myself out of my room, then dart down the stairs in my slippers and out onto the veranda, stopping upon the last step so I don't wet my toes. Max, I call, and his head shoots up, spraying snow off his ears. The girl stops running and stares at me, then throws her hands at the beastie as though in presentation.
I've brought the dog, she says in German. Money, please.
Did he get out? I ask, making a tentative crossing of the snowy lawn toward her. My slippers, made for ladylike treads across carpet, are soaked by the time I reach her, but there is no chance the dog will be moved by this girl as delicate as a snowflake. The girl puts her hand atop Max's enormous head, giving him a two-fingered stroke between the eyes.
No, the lady at the carriage stop in Stuttgart gave me a kreuzer and said if I brought the dog back to the pink house, someone would give me another. But he looked so sad, I thought he might want to play.
I'm not sure how this small creature got Max anywhere, particularly when she hooks a hand around his bow and tries to pull him over to me. She seems to be throwing her whole weight into the act, and he barely budges. Stuttgart is at least 2 miles of playing carrot and stick with this creature away. I suddenly realize I have entirely missed the key word of her statement. Sorry? What lady?
The lady from the pink house in the country. They wouldn't let her bring the dog on the diligence, so she said you'd give me a kreuzer.
I don't have a coin for you, I interrupt. You can go ask around the service door if you want your payment. As the girl prances off through the yard, I bend down and stroke Max on the head. What were you doing in Stuttgart? You should be upstairs with Joanna getting dressed up for the big day. He snort whines, expelling a puff of frozen slobber from his jowls and nudges his face into my skirt. His black lips pool against my knee. Come on, let's go find her. I drag him up by the loose skin around his neck. I swear I lose sight of my hand in all the fur and folds and pull him back into the house, then up the stairs toward Joanna's room. He's a reluctant companion, whining and dragging his massive paws and offering such passive resistance that I'm winded by the time we reach the door to Joanna's apartments. Max shakes himself off, and I'm drenched in a combination of the snow thrown from his fur and long ribbons of slobber. I swear some fly off and adhere to the ceiling, where they cling like rock formations in a cave. Hunched over, with the dog cuffed under one arm, my hair in my face, and most of me soaked in muddy snow, I'm a proper vagrant when I knock on Joanna's bedroom door. Joanna? I can feel the sleeve of my dress slowly soaking as Max leaks saliva into it. Joanna, I've got Max. I think he got out. No answer. I knock again, harder this time. Joanna? I give a tentative push on the door, and it swings open. Max presses his massive forehead into the back of my knees like he's trying to hide, but instead ends up nudging me into the room. It's empty. Her wedding dress is hanging unworn, her bed made, and the fire cold, unstoked since the night previous. Max galumphs in ahead of me, makes a slow heft of his girth onto the bed and turns around 3 times before flopping down. I take a few more steps inside. Joanna, I call, though it's obvious she isn't here. The washroom is dark, the essential items of her toilette gone, and the bedsheets cold, but where Max has already begun to sink into them. Joanna is gone. Not just gone, but seemingly not here at all last night. I have to tell someone. It will delay my own departure, but there's a whole wedding party about to assemble in her honour, a garden full of flowers being arranged below stairs, a chapel full of guests who will be left staring at an empty aisle, not to mention the humiliation for the groom to be standing at the altar, waiting and waiting and waiting, only to find his bride has vanished. I have to tell Dr. Platt. I'm fairly certain I know which room is his, though the first door I knock upon is answered by the deaf relative I sat beside at my first dinner. I apologize and move on to the next, rapping upon it so hard my knuckles smart. Dr. Platt answers in a banyan and cap, his eyes bloodshot. Miss Montague! He scrubs a hand against his face. It's early. Joanna's gone, I blurt out. He blinks hard several times, like he's trying to translate my words from a language of which he only knows a few words. What? Her room is empty, and there was a girl in the yard who brought Max and said that she was given a coin by a woman getting on a diligence to bring him back to the house. Come inside. He ushers me into his room, closing the door behind us. Cleanliness is clearly not a prominent water feature in the courtyard of his life, as he seems to have nothing in his wardrobe and everything upon the floor. There are sets of dishes with dried crusts of food stacked on a table by the fire, which he pulls a chair from and offers me. He retrieves his snuff box from the nightstand before pulling up a stool for himself. "Do you need a drink?" he asks, and I shake my head, though even sitting down I am unable to be still, my knee bouncing up and down. "Tell me slowly now, from the beginning." When I'm finished explaining, he asks, "Are you certain she's gone? She may be elsewhere in the house. Did you check?" "She didn't sleep in her bed last night," I interrupt. "It was still made. The fire was cold. Things were missing from her dressing room." "Did the child say where the diligence was headed?" I shake my head. "Do you know where she would have gone, or why?" My mind flits briefly to the night before, the letter clutched between us, and Joanna furious and serious and entirely not herself. But there's no proof that was due to anything other than her learning that I had set her up to be robbed. "No, sir." He nods, tugging the sash on his banyan tighter.
"I'll have the staff search the house and grounds to be certain, and alert her uncle. Let me dress, and then you and I can go to Stuttgart and see if we can find out where she's gone."
Platt sends the butler to the chapel to let the priest know the service may be delayed, while I do my best to shake off the bridal attendants beginning to assemble in the parlour. By the time Platt and I depart for Stuttgart, Joanna's uncle and the groundskeeper have his hunting dogs on leads, ready to launch a search of the woods that frame the house. Platt and I take a carriage from the house to the diligence stop in the city, where the clerk confirms that a young woman and her giant dog arrived early this morning seeking a departure. However, while the dog was sent back to the house with the girl due to not fitting comfortably inside the carriage, Joanna got herself on the first southbound coach this morning from Frankfurt to Genoa. The clerk counts out the next stops for us on his fingers.
Rothenburg, Albstadt, Memmingen, Ravensburg, Schaffhausen, Zürich.
Zürich? I can see it on the seal of the letter I tore from Sim. Did Joanna tell Platt about Sim? Did it matter at all to her? Did she dismiss it when he interrupted us because it didn't matter, or because she didn't want him to know? Do I have a hand in her sudden departure, or is it just a severe manifestation of nerves before a wedding, and my betrayal was just an enormous coincidence?
What were you thinking, Joanna?
Outside the travel office, Platt slaps his gloves against his hands absently, blowing a long, milky breath into the air before he declares,
"I'm going to send word to the chapel that we're postponing the ceremony, and then follow the route. See if I can't catch up with the diligence or find her at any of the stops. She can't have gone far. She'll miss all the comforts she's used to within the day."
I'm not certain he's right about that. Joanna Hoffman may seem like a girl who would be out of her depth in a mud puddle, but I don't think she'd run without a plan. Or, at the least, a very good reason. though I can't fathom what that might be. I think, I start, but falter when he looks at me. His gaze is hawk-sharp, and the chance of the letter I intercepted being in any way tied to her flight is so thin it feels likely to snap as soon as it's tested. I take a deep breath. She may be heading to Zurich.
What makes you think that?
He asks. Last night, I caught my maid robbing her. She tried to take a letter, and the seal was from Zurich.
A letter? Do you have it with you?
I shake my head.
Do you remember anything about it?
Kunstkammer Staub? That was on the seal. I trip so badly over the pronunciation, I blush, suddenly feeling foolish, not just for my poor German, but also for thinking this was worth mentioning. It may be nothing.
Or perhaps not.
He rubs a hand over his chin. He hasn't shaved, and his cheeks are peppered with coarse stubble.
We should go to Zurich. I've a house rented there for our honeymoon, so at least we'll have somewhere to set up.
We? I repeat.
Ah, yes.
He tucks his hands into his coat pockets with a smile.
I was going to speak to you of this last night, but we never found each other. I gave quite a lot of thought to how I might best use you, and I can certainly find space for you on my expedition staff.
It's like the whole world shifts. The light gets brighter, the snow whiter, the sky glacier blue. The bitter wind clattering shop signs against their chains quiets. For one quiet moment, the world is still, and it is mine. My legs feel firmly planted under me for the first time in years, maybe my whole life. Nothing has been ruined. No rift in the earth opened between me and the greatest living physician. I left out the damning details of how Sim got into their house, but either he didn't notice or didn't care. He still wants me. Platt pulls his scarf up over his nose, squinting down the street, and seemingly oblivious to the fact that in one sentence he has given me a chance I would have cut off my own feet and eaten them raw for.
Though this damn expedition will never get off the ground if we can't find Miss Hoffman.
The wind picks back up, and a spray of muddy snow splatters across the hem of my dress as a passing carriage strikes a rut. Why not? He's pulled out his snuff box and tipped a thimbleful onto the back of his hand, shielding it from the wind with a cupped palm. But he pauses, eyes flickering to me. Then he says,
"What sort of man would leave the country while his fiancée is missing?"
He takes a snort and shakes his head a few times.
"Please come. You're her friend. She trusts you. Whatever has inspired this hysteria, perhaps you can talk her down from it. Miss Montague, I need your help."
It was not quite the context in which I had imagined Alexander Platt would ask me for my help. In my fantasies, it was from the other side of an operating table, in a time of crisis, with everyone panicking over a tangled intestine no one could unravel until I stepped up. But I'll take whatever scraps I'm thrown, no matter how tired I am of not having a seat at the table. "Let's find Joanna," I say. Platt wastes no time on public transport. He hires us a carriage and a driver and foots every bill for accommodations, which is a vast improvement upon my original plan of limping back to England by way of public coaches and sleeping at the sheltered stops along the way. And though I am not particularly fussy and have done my share of sleeping in open fields with only my own two arms to pillow my head, I prefer beds and roofs and heated foot warmers in an enclosed carriage when they are made available to me. Platt is a gentleman. He doesn't sit on the same side of the bench as I do and lets me ride forward while he sits with his back to the coachman. He takes quite a lot more snuff than I have ever seen a man ingest, and I lived with Monty. Though, of all his vices, Monty was never one for snuff. Platt snorts it like clockwork, a deep inhale through the nose every quarter hour, and when we stop for the night, he leaves our inn and ventures out into the frigid winter to purchase more. The next morning, over breakfast, he adds laudanum to his coffee and complains of the poor quality of tobacco to be found in this town. It reminds me of my brother, who, before our tour, would take brandy in the mornings after a night drinking himself sick at the clubs, smelled of whiskey more often than aftershave, and who, had he ever duelled, he would likely have been saved from a fatal bullet by the flask in his breast pocket. I know now why. After years of abuse at the hands of our father, he had felt himself unable to experience the world sober. It makes me wonder what demons Alexander Platt keeps barricaded away with that small box of shimmering powder. I am not certain how to speak to him, and so, at first, we do very little of that. I want to ask him everything, about his work, his research, the wards he's walked and the ships he's sailed on, what he thinks about Robert Hooke's presentation of artificial respiration before the Royal Society, whether he agrees with Archibald Pitcairn that fevers are best cured by evacuating medicines, because that had always seemed overly simplistic to me. But none of this seems appropriate to ask a man whose bride has fled the altar, even if he is one's hero. But one can only spend so long bookless in the company of another human before one feels compelled to make conversation, particularly when one of those humans has just offered the other an opportunity that has her stoked as a just-fed fire. So about the position. I say it so fast and with so little grace that he looks up from notations he's been making in a small book with a frown.
Pardon me?
I swallow. I was hoping, maybe, you could tell me more about the sort of work I'll be doing for you.
Work?
He repeats. The position with your expedition.
Oh, of course.
He closes his book around the pencil, marking his place.
While I'm away in the Barbary States, it would be helpful to have someone at my office in London to keep track of my correspondence and finances. Transcribe notations sent from abroad. I can't pay you much, unfortunately, but you know how these things are, always so short on funds.
I don't know, actually. I am not sure what things he's referring to. Medicine, or expeditions, or any position that's held by a woman. So, I'd be your secretary, I say.
Assistant, he corrects.
When I don't reply, he adds,
You look disappointed.
It's not quite what I had in mind, I say, as tactful a response as I can muster. I was hoping for something more practical. He's fishing in his jacket again, and I expect to see the snuff box, but instead it's a handkerchief. He blows his nose, then, when he finds me still silent, laughs.
What more would you want?
I'd like to study, I reply, and work, not just take notes for someone who is. He swipes a thumb over his chin, then folds his handkerchief with such precision it makes me want to scoot away from him, though there's nowhere to go in this carriage.
Miss Montague, he says, let me be clear about something. You'll not be given many chances for employment in this field because of the inferiority of your sex. I'm kind enough to offer you this when most physicians won't entertain the idea of a woman in their office managing their research. This is not an opportunity you'll be offered again, from anyone.
It is a blunt battering ram of a tone, the sort that makes me suddenly aware that it is just the two of us in this small space on this empty country road. He leans back, kicking one foot up on the opposite knee with such grandness that his toe knocks into my shin.
Might I suggest some gratitude? It's far more becoming.
I'm sorry, I say, and I hate that I am apologising to him when it is he who kicked me, he who has made me feel that I'm in the wrong for daring to ask for something, not even something, for anything. He has me apologizing for asking for the minimum that is granted to most men.
You needn't apologize for ambition, he says, flipping his book open again and taking up his pencil. Just know that most men will find it unseemly in a woman.
I turn away from him and stare out the window, watching the white countryside pass us by and trying to resist the urge to open the door, step out onto the road and make my own way rather than spend a minute longer in this coach.
Once we get to Zurich, he says,
and his voice feels floating and far away.
You'll help me find Joanna, won't you, Felicity?
Yes, sir, I reply. And the conversation between my hero, your hero, your idol, your favourite doctor, I remind myself over and over in time with the clattering carriage wheels, whittles into nothing.
Zurich. 11. The house in Zurich is ready for us when we arrive. Well, not us, Joanna and Platt. It's a modest townhouse near the shore of the lake, not so close that you can hear the port, but not so far away as to be overly fashionable. The staff is just a cook, a housekeeper, and a valet, who all do an admirable job of hiding their surprise when Dr. Platt introduces me as Miss Montague rather than Mrs. Platt. We arrive late in the evening, the street lamps already glowing and the lake a glassy reflection of the sky. The housekeeper takes me up to my room, brings me supper on a tray, and heats coals for my bed warmer before leaving me to sleep. I'm flattened from the travelling, but the house keeps me awake. Perhaps it is just being unaccustomed to strange sounds of a strange place and a strange city as well. Perhaps it's the way I can hear Dr. Platt in the sitting room below me, his footsteps on the floorboards, the clink of a decanter against the rim of a glass more times than seems advisable. I drift off without realizing it, but I'm woken abruptly by the sound of my bedroom door opening and the faint beam of a lantern being unsheathed, which disappears almost at once. There are a few rough footsteps, then my bedroom door bangs shut, and an unfamiliar male voice asks in English,
"Who is that?" "Keep your voice down," Platt hisses. "God, you didn't have to barge in. I knew you were lying. I knew it." "I didn't lie. That's not your wife, Alex."
I don't move, debating whether they'll be back, whether it is wiser for me to continue to feign sleep or to bolt suddenly awake. The intensity of their voices, and that they are two men and I a woman alone, sits deep in my bones like a bad fever.
"So where is Mrs. Platt?" the stranger's voice asks, farther away now. The stairs creak beneath their feet.
Their voices peter out as they get farther down the stairs. I sit up, straining to hear. I am no dropper of eaves, but it seems in my best interest, and Joanna's, to know what is being said about us behind closed doors, or rather, in the hallways outside them. I scramble out of bed and to the door, then ease myself out as quietly as possible, and glide sock-footed to the top of the stairs. From that vantage point, I can see across the entryway and into a sliver of the sitting room where they've taken up residence. From where he's seated on the couch, Platt's shoulder and the back of his head are barely visible.
"In the city somewhere," he's saying. "She's also not Mrs. Platt yet." "Dear God, Alex, I thought you could handle this." "I can. I am. Handling it." "What was wrong with taking her to Poland?" the stranger asks.
His accent is English, with a crisp precision that reeks of hunting parties and Cambridge classrooms.
"She would have suspected a proposition of elopement," Platt starts, but the man cuts him off. "What do you do if she gets there before you?"
"It doesn't matter. They'll never let her near the archive. She needs me."
The second gentleman cuts Platt off with a growling sigh. He's standing too far away from me to see him, but I get a brief view from the waist down as he crosses in front of the fireplace. A thick wool grey coat and tall boots crusted with salt. Sailor's boots, but far too fine for a seaman. They look like pieces of a uniform. There's a strangled silence. Platt is staring at the floor, his elbows on his knees.
"I will fix this," he says at last.
"You'd best."
The decanter clinks again. Platt reaches out for the glass he's offered.
"So," the second man asks, "who is the girl in your bedroom, if it isn't Miss Hoffman?"
My heartbeat jumps, and I lean forward just as Platt settles back into his seat, his elbow perched on the armrest at such a jaunty angle that some of the liquor sloshes out of his glass.
"You won't believe me if I tell you. Do you know Lord Henry Montague?"
My fists close on the banister, the hard ridges of the wood jutting into my palm.
"The English Earl?" the second man asks.
"The same."
Platt tips a finger over his shoulder towards the stairs above which he thinks I'm sleeping.
"That's his child."
"What?"
"His kidnapped girl in the flesh. His lordship has been telling the whole peerage that his children were taken by slavers in the Mediterranean, but, as it happens, they ran away."
He takes a loud slurp from his drink, then lets it dangle between his thumb and forefinger.
"Can you imagine the scandal if the truth got out?"
My palms start to sweat against the banister. Monty and I both wrote to our parents when we first resolved not to return home after our tour. Me to a stifled existence and a loveless marriage. Monty to likely the same, but with a good deal more damage from our father done to him along the way. And while we didn't exactly send a forwarding address, Father's lack of reply had led Monty and me to optimistically agree that he had decided to quietly blot our names from the family tree, bet his estate upon the new baby son, and let us go our own ways. Apparently, he has taken a far more dramatic route, telling everyone we were taken by corsairs, and now Platt has the evidence to prove otherwise. In the parlour, I hear the second man say,
"You're going to kidnap the daughter of a lord and blackmail him?"
"There is no kidnapping," Platt replies. "She came willingly. Miss Montague will help me find Joanna and see us married. Then we collect Sybil Glass's work and send the ladies back to England, and Montague's help will keep us afloat and see Herr Hoffman paid for his ships. See? All in my control, Fitz."
I should be afraid. I'm certainly trembling. Platt knows who I am and will use me to find Joanna, and then plans to send me back to my father. All the while I'd thought us allies, I'd been no more than a pawn. And that has my vision spotting with anger. Anger for being used, for being thought foolish, for knowing that he'd likely never thought me capable of medical work. He'd just recognised my name. I need to leave this house at once and find Joanna and warn her that whatever love Platt professed to have for her is false and the wedding is a sham. If it was Platt she ran from, I've led him straight to her door. She may think she's safe until the moment his jaws snap closed around her, all because of me. The conversation in the parlour has moved to sailing, and if I do not leave now, I may not get another chance. I slip back into my room and change from my nightdress into my tartan skirt and bodice. They're reeking from the travel, the hair muddied up to the knees and the material crusty with sweat that has dried and then dampened over and over again as we went from stifling carriages to frigid station stops. My cloak is in a closet below stairs, and I do not dare creep down for it, nor do I dare bolt into the cold without it. Instead, I strip the quilt off the bed and wrap that around my shoulders. Then, the much more complex task at hand,
The actual escape. Ice on the window cracks when I shove it open, and a gust of wind pushes back so hard I almost lose my grip. The pelmet curtain is sucked out, and the shutters clap against the side of the house. Below is an unhelpful drop to the street. No footholds, ledges, or loose bricks promised me by every fiction book I have ever read. Not even a convenient hedge to drop into. I have never been in possession of any particular acrobatic skills, and, having the proportions of a corgi dog, do not anticipate a burst of natural athleticism to manifest just in time for me to scale the side of a building. I drag the window shut, then take a breath and an inventory. Resources at my disposal. Very few. The sparse furnishings of this room, which would only be valuable if they could be subtly pushed out the window to create some sort of precarious tower. My knapsack, full of nothing useful, stockings and underthings and a few books. I open the cupboard in the corner and find additional bed dressings and towels. The only idea seems to be taking up the role of the towered princess who grows weary of waiting for a knight, a rope made of her bedroom's drapery. The sheets tear quietly and braid easily. Years of keeping my hair in a long plait has finally done more than garner ire from fussier peers. I tear, braid, and braid again, then tie a firm knot around the rod hammered into the wall to hold the pelmet over the window. I sling my knapsack over my shoulder, test my weight upon the rope to be certain I won't fall to my death if the plaster is ripped from the wall. Well, death is rather grand. Perhaps fall to my two broken ankles more accurately. Then I brace my feet against the casements and rescue myself. In the shelter of the bowing streets, the city is warmer than the countryside, and in spite of the snowfall, I've sweated through my scarf by the time I arrive at the diligence stop where the carriage from Stuttgart comes in daily. I pay the link boy, lighting lamps for me with coins left over from supper the night before, and then stand alone on the side of the street, the sludgy snowflakes trickling through the clouds, making lace trimmings on my eyelashes, trying to think where I would go if I were a girl alone in a city, likely coming in the dark and the cold. Which I am, I realise. But I try not to linger too long on that, lest my fear swallow me whole. I think of Joanna, everything I know of her, where I would go if I were her. I would go home to Stuttgart and my giant dog and my frilly dresses is the first thing I think. But the Joanna I knew back in Cheshire had once slept for 3 nights in her father's stables in winter in hopes of seeing the snowy owl she suspected had made its nest in the rafters, had fallen through ice on a pond and pulled herself out before anyone could help her. A girl who had survived without a father and a mother who wouldn't come home when she lost him. Perhaps she is still made of that stone foundation I watched her build as a child. Perhaps it has not eroded with time, but grown stronger, and been draped in silk and dog saliva. If I were Joanna, I think, I would want somewhere Platt wouldn't find me. Not somewhere he'd expect her to stay. A guest house along the river with polished floors and silk sheets. I'd want to hide. I'd want somewhere tongues didn't wag and runaway girls weren't noticeable and men were not allowed. Somewhere like the boarding house I had called home in Edinburgh. And, if I had a trunk in tow, somewhere nearby. The streets of the old town are steep and winding, a combination of cobbles so slick with snow it's almost necessary to take them upon all fours, and rough stairways just as treacherous but with more sharp edges when fallen upon. The diligence stop shares its corner with a trinket shop advertising tarot readings, shut up and looking as though it hasn't been opened in weeks, a cobbler with faded velvet slippers in the window, and a cafe spilling violin music, and the soft clink of a night that's crowded, but not busy. I make my way inside, picking through the tables populated with drunk artists staring into the bottom of gin bottles and painted ladies swooning around them. The man behind the bar is wiry and thin, with a thick moustache and a weathered kerchief tied around his neck. He's missing two teeth on the bottom, and he greets me with a rasping, wet cough before asking in a gritty voice,
"You want something to drink?"
"No, sir, actually." I make a big show of swallowing, willing myself to get tears in my eyes, just for fullest effect. "It's my sister."
"Your sister?" he repeats.
"She's run away from home because our father is a tyrant who would see her shipped off to an asylum just for being a girl who reads books." I am poaching a bit of everyone's life story for this lie, but I press on. "She's come here to Zurich, and I know she's just arrived, and I'm trying to find her, and I think she came in here a few days ago, and please, sir." The damn tears just aren't coming. I spent so many years training myself to not show any sort of weakness, even under desperate circumstances, that my face seems utterly confused about what it is I'm asking it to do. I'm screwing up my nose and snuffling, and I think it looks more like I'm about to sneeze than trying to cry, for the bartender just looks confused. "Please, sir," I squeak, trying to put a teary wobble in my voice and overshooting, so it instead sounds like I just inhaled a mouthful of pepper. "If you know anything of where she might be, I just want to find her." He gives me a heavy-lidded look, still wiping endless circles around the glass in his hand. I likely could have told this bartender that I was looking for Joanna so I could murder her in cold blood, and he wouldn't have cared. He doesn't seem to give a fig about my tragic, albeit fake, story, or my similarly tragic, though only because of their fakeness, tears.
"Why would I know?"
"Surely you see unfortunates in here begging for your help?"
"Unfortunates are the only kinds we see here, madam."
He coughs again, this time pulling up the kerchief around his neck to cover his mouth. The material is wet and worn, the striped pattern faded into pilled cotton around the edges, like he often pulls it up. There are no bloodstains, though, so if he's coughing into it often, it's not a consumptive hack. This close, I can hear his lungs cracking every time he takes a breath, like the spine of a book opened for the first time. "Do you suffer from asthma, sir?" I ask before I can stop myself. He pauses in wiping down glasses and, for the first time, seems to pay me attention.
"Do I what?"
"Asthma," I repeat, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a word I learned from reading Dr. John Floyer's treatise, and I've never said it outside my own head. A respiratory condition that causes laboured breathing and chest contractions.
"Don't know,"
he replies. "Do you often have trouble breathing deeply?"
"Most days. I take laudanum for it."
"Have you tried tar water and nettle juice instead? They're much better for a constricted throat, and there's less risk of dependency. Less expensive, too. Some quacks will tell you that boiled carrots help the lungs, but tar water has proved the most effective treatment. Any pharmacy should carry some, or make it up for you." He stares at me, trying to decide whether I'm making a joke, then coughs again, this time with his mouth closed so that his cheeks puff out. "It's remarkable the difference a good deep breath can make," I offer. He huffs, presses his fist to his chest, then says,
"She's really your sister, is she?"
When I nod, he says,
"We get lots of unsavory types in here looking for girls who don't want to be found."
"Do I look unsavory?"
"You've got no cloak."
"That makes me unfortunate, I should think." He huffs again, wiping his nose on the back of his hand.
"When we get girls wandering in, I send them to Frau Engels near the chapel. She's a boarding house for waywards. The only one you can walk to from here. Your sister may be there.
Do you remember a girl with...
We get a lot of girls, he interrupts, and I send them all to Frau Engel.
Thank you, sir. I start to leave, but he calls to me.
What was it? Tar juice?
I turn in the doorway. Tar water and nettle juice. I hope it helps. He nods.
I hope you find your sister.
Frau Engel is similarly unmoved by my tragic story, though she has no illness I can diagnose to soften her heart. I make no attempt at tears this time.
Could be anyone, she says.
She's in her nightdress and cap, but the lit clay pipe between her teeth assures me I didn't wake her. Her large frame occupies most of the door.
I get a dozen girls in and out of here each day. I don't know them all.
She looks as though she's about to close the door in my face, so I throw out a preemptive arm against the frame in the hope that she will at least have enough pity in her heart not to crunch my fingers and say, "Please, you must remember." She shrugs, her clay pipe bouncing between her teeth.
All girls are the same. You want to pay me for a bed? You can wander around and try to find her yourself, but make the decision quick so I can get back to bed.
I give her all the coins I have left without a clue of what she's charging. I'm fairly certain it's too much for a single night, but she doesn't offer me anything back. Just her rumps, then gives me a tin plate, a cutlery set, and a blanket made of rough ticking that smells as though it were last used to rub down a horse.
Two girls to a bed, three if you can't find a spot. Washrooms on the second floor.
I'm not actually saying. I just want to find my sister.
Still two to a bed, she says,
drawing back so I can pass, then adds,
and don't run off with my blanket.
She says that like the withered carcass of material would have any value. There are so many holes, it seems like it would not even serve the most basic purpose of blanketness.
And don't wake me again, she calls as she glumps back to her room,
a thin finger of smoke from her pipe lingering behind. The boarding house is packed above stairs and smells of mould and wax. Large pieces of the wallpaper are peeling away, leaving raw patches of damp wood that splinter when I brush them. I wander the second and third floor bedrooms, feeling invasive and downright criminal as I peer at all these sleeping girls, squinting through the darkness to see if any of them is Joanna. I'm not sure what I'll do if I find her, wake her, or sit beside her bed and keep vigil until morning, or perhaps lie down beside her and sleep myself, though the question is rendered irrelevant as I finish my lap and find her nowhere. Most beds are full, and most with more than two girls. I see four knotted up together upon one small, stiff mattress, the littlest no more than 12, and all of them curled around each other like kittens. They're all thin and pale. One girl keeps coughing into her fist, trying to stifle the sound. Most are asleep. A few are gathered in one corner, whispering around a lamp and a deck of cards that they're using to tell fortunes. Another is sitting naked and shivering as she stitches up a seam in what must be her only dress. I almost give her my horse blanket to cover herself, though that feels as if it may do less good than my intentions would merit. On the third floor, I find two girls wedged into the windowsill, looking out at the snowfall and giggling as they press their lips together. When they notice me in the doorway, one of them starts hissing in French I can't understand, simply for all the extra air in her words. When I don't reply or react, she unpeels herself from her friend and starts coming for me. I bolt, stumbling over the end of a bed and dropping my blanket cutlery bundle with a clatter that jolts half the room awake, and then there are more than a few girls who seem to want to skin me alive. I dash back into a hallway, down the rickety stairs, and smash headlong into the girl coming out of the washroom so hard that I nearly knock the lamp from her hand. Felicity! It takes me a moment before I recognize her.
Joanna!
Without powder, pomade, or cosmetics, she looks a different person. Her skin is cratered with scars. I had forgotten she had measles when we were 10, and blotched with dry spots from the harsh winter air. Her hair is loose and falls to her waist, kinked from its plaits and lank with the sweat of a long journey. We stare at each other through the darkness, the thin beam of Joanna's lamp bathing us in a rosy glow.
"What are you doing here?"
she hisses. There are footsteps on the stairs, the two kissing girls likely leading their floor in revolution against me for waking them. Joanna's eyes flit over my shoulder, and I worry she might try to escape me before I've had a chance to explain, but instead she grabs me around the wrist and drags me into the washroom, bolting the door behind us. The lantern in her hand bobs like a drunkard. I stumble into the washroom, the backs of my legs connecting painfully with the wash basin. Joanna stands with her back to the door, facing me. The washroom is hardly big enough for the two of us, and my shoes cling to the sticky floor.
"How did you find me?"
she demands, her voice still absurdly high, even when hissed through a clenched jaw.
"Did you think it would be hard?"
I retort.
"Yes, I thought it was quite a good flight."
"Oh, please, you tried to take your elephant of a dog on a diligence with you." Her frown turns inward, disappointment in herself rather than me.
"Yes, that wasn't as sneaky as I wanted, but I couldn't leave Max. You didn't bring him, did you?"
she adds, her voice brightening for a moment before she remembers she's furious with me.
"Wait, no. Tell me why you're here."
"I'm here to warn you."
"Warn me? About what?"
I take a deep breath. "I have reason to believe that Dr. Platt's intentions with you are not noble." I expected her to gasp, step back, and press a hand to her chest in the sort of theatrical shock ladies often indulge in. At the very least, a whispered,
"No."
Instead, she crosses her arms and gives me a withering stare.
"Really? That's the revelatory information you came all this way to deliver."
I nearly execute the step back and hand press I had been so ready to judge her for.
"You knew?"
"Knew what?
That he's a crook and an addict and a degenerate? Of course I did. He's laid out more often than he's sober, and all his business with my uncle is done on credit because he's spent a fortune on opium."
"I thought you were in love with him." She laughs, a brittle sound like a step upon thin ice.
"You think I'm so stupid that a strange man shows up at my door asking for my hand and I just swoon and say yes?"
I don't say anything, which only confirms that I do think her shallow enough to fall so hard and so fast for the first man she met who could fill a pair of breeches.
"So why were you going to marry him?" I ask.
"Because I didn't have a choice," she replies, sinking down so that she's sitting on the edge of the tub, then immediately standing again and wiping something off her nightdress.
"My uncle was forcing me, and I didn't know how to escape him. I was scared."
"So you ran away to honeymoon on your own?"
"No. I came to Zurich because that letter your maid stole, it's from the cabinet of curiosities my mother was working for when she died, and they have all her effects."
"Effects?" I repeat.
"Everything she had with her," Joanna explains. "The idiot curator will only give them to a male member of my family. When you told me your maid or friend or benefactress or whatever she was had tried to snatch the letter, it was enough of a push to finally do the thing I had been afraid to, and come here myself, to get them before she could."
"You think Sim's after your mother's effects?" I ask. I had been so focused on Platt, trying to use Joanna's story to fill in the gaps I'd overheard in his, that I'd forgotten Sim.
"Why else would she care about that letter? I think it likely she convinced you to bring her to my home because she assumed we had already collected them and hoped to steal them, but then learned from that letter they're here in Zurich at the Kunstkammerstaub."
I think Platt's after them too, I say. I overheard him talking about his voyage, and he said something about the archive and a cabinet. Did he ever mention that to you? She shakes her head, forehead creasing.
No, never. He asked about my mother and father when we first met, but I asked about his, just getting to know you.
What work was your mother doing that's so valuable to both him and Sim? I can't come up with something that would wed their two worlds.
I don't entirely know, Joanna replies. She was working as an artist assistant to a naturalist on an expedition to the Barbary Coast, one of many journeys.
I didn't know that.
My father said he'd send me to a plantation in Barbados if I told anyone. He was so embarrassed by her. To have a wife literally run from your home in the middle of the night to sail with unspeakables?
She runs her fingers through the ends of her hair, pulling at the knots.
But she wrote to me on all her voyages, sent me such strange things.
All your stories, I say, realization dawning suddenly upon me. She looks up.
When we were children, you always had such great adventures we would pretend to go on. Those were from her letters.
You remember that?
Of course I remember that. Those were...
The lamplight jumps against the wall, making skeletons of our shadows.
Those were the best days.
They were, weren't they?
Her nose wrinkles up into a sly smile.
Dr. Brilliant?
I roll my eyes. Ha ha, I was only six. I had not yet peaked creatively.
No, it's sweet.
She laughs. Everyone should give themselves an aspirational fake name.
Well, what about you, famous naturalist?
Were my revelation any more sudden, it would have knocked me flat. I actually have to reach back and steady myself against the basin. I go so light-headed.
Joanna, still oblivious, continues with that goading smile that wrinkles her nose.
Go on, do you remember?
Sybil Glass, I say, and I hear it in my head in Platt's voice.
Was that your mother's name?
She nods with a wistful sigh.
I wanted to be just like Joanna. I overheard Platt just now, I say, talking to some English bloke about Sybil Glass and collecting her work.
She almost drops the lamp.
Platt is in Zurich. You brought him here?
No, he brought me, I explain. The cabinet will only surrender her things to a male member of your family, yes?
Do you think that's why he wanted to marry you, so he'd have legal claim to whatever it is she was working on?
Joanna sucks in her cheeks hard, mouth puckering. Then she lets go a breath laced with,
"Son of a bitch!"
It is not a situation for laughing, but I do anyway. In her lilting soprano, it's like hearing a curse in a homily.
"He can't get them, so long as you aren't wed.
Doesn't mean he won't try." She presses a fist against her chin, thumb tapping in rhythm to her thoughts.
"I'm going to go to the Kunstkammer tomorrow to see if they'll give me my mother's effects."
"No, you have to get out of here before Platt can force a ring upon you," I say. "The effects are legally yours, so long as you don't marry him. He has no claim. Come back to England with me. We can figure things out there, about him and Sim, if you think she's after them too."
"Are you encouraging me to run from a fight?" she says, and it almost sounds like a challenge.
It's too dark to properly tell what kind of smile is flirting with her lips.
"I thought you were the brave one out of the pair of us."
"What? No, no fighting," I say, then add, "and you were the intrepid explorer in our games, remember? I was the level-headed tag-along."
"Yes, because make-believe is most fun if you can pretend to be something you're not. It took me until the night before my wedding to leave because I've been so afraid to be alone."
She scrapes her hand through her hair, pushing it back from her face.
"Maybe I shouldn't have run. Maybe there was another way, or I should have asked for help or not acted so spontaneously. But I'm here, and I am determined, and I am going to the museum tomorrow, and..."
You don't have to defend yourself, I say quickly. Not to me.
Oh, good. Well, I'm possibly still making defences in my own head.
She smooths out her nightdress between her fingers, then looks up at me.
Do you need money?
Money, I repeat, to get back to England. I don't have much, and I can't say I feel particularly obligated to give you a comfortable way home if I'm paying.
Home? I have nowhere to go. No Platt, no Sim, no family, no lifelines. I cut my ties and am drifting alone, a lifeboat in a windless surf.
Could I come with you? I ask.
Joanna looks up sharply, and I add, I already paid for a night, and I can't go back to Platt, so I might as well stay here. And I'm not... I mean, there's no hurry.
I peter into a shrug, and a toe scuffed against the floor, or rather, an attempt at a scuffed toe, for the floor is so sticky that it's more of a squelch. I don't dare look at her for fear she'll say no, so before she can, I take my pieces off the board.
Sorry, never mind. You probably don't want a thing to do with me. I mean, if you want me to come, I thought maybe I could, but you probably don't, so I'll leave first thing.
Are you having a conversation with yourself?
No, I'm conversing with you.
Then give me a chance to answer, will you?
You can come, if you'd like. Though I can't imagine Dr. Platt will look favourably upon any of his future protégés conspiring against him. If I join Joanna, I will give up on any chance of working for Dr. Platt. Even after overhearing his conversation back at the house and knowing he'd use me ill, it is such a large thing to let go of. Staying with Joanna means I'm betting on nothing. Except her, and her mother, and myself.
Well, I reply, good thing I'd rather not be any man's protégé.
12. The Kunstkammer is located on the Limmatquay, its back sloping into the river. The water froths fast and dark in the miserable weather. The sky is grey, and it snows with intermittent strength as we make the trek across the city. And when Joanna and I arrive at the collection, we are both soaked through our cloaks, mine borrowed from Joanna, so I don't damage our already shaky credibility with dodgy outerwear. A layer of snowflakes dust our shoulders like sugar atop a bun. Joanna made a valiant attempt to arrange her hair before we left that morning, and at her insistence, I made a valiant attempt to help her, though was dismissed from my responsibilities when I stabbed her in the back of the head with a pin so hard it drew blood. In her flight from her father's home, though she couldn't bring her dog, she did bring a trunk's worth of extravagant dresses, and a pink skirt hemmed with mint-coloured ruffles peers out from under her cloak. In my plain Brunswick, I'm much more likely of the pair of us to be taken seriously by the men who dart behind the exhibits of bugs and stuffed animals here.
I wish I had Max, Joanna says, as we cross the entryway of the cabinet to the ticket desk, eyeing the stuffed form of some kind of devilish-looking wildcat rearing over us from a pedestal in the centre.
I don't think he'd win against that, I say, with a nod up at the cat.
You've never seen him really go after a slipper, she replies. We step up behind a woman paying for admission for herself and a tiny boy with beautiful blonde curls that have somehow thwarted the snow and remained perfectly ruffled. Joanna takes a long, tight breath, one hand pressed against her stomach.
I just always feel better with my dog. Don't be nervous, I say. You've got right on your side.
When has that ever mattered? She murmurs.
The woman and the blonde boy move away from the desk, and Joanna and I step up to the attendant.
Good morning,
Joanna chirps, and I immediately cringe at how high her voice is, how pitchy and giggly she sounds,
and how silly that pink dress looks.
I was hoping I might speak to the curator, Herr Wagner.
The clerk, who has been prepared only to take our money,